The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Never in my life did I think that one day I would be watching the UN Security Council discussing the serious threats to international peace and security being posed by an authoritarian U.S. government, but that's where we are now. After listening to that meeting, I spoke with my good friend Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here's part one of that conversation. Let's start from the top. According to the last thing I saw to Marco Rubio was that we have not declared war. All we did was, you know, bomb and missile and kidnap the head of state. And technically, there's no declaration of war. So I suppose Marco was for once telling the truth.
Yeah, I've been having a little debate with a colleague of mine who's trying to look for the grand strategy behind all of this, like there's a pattern or something. And, you know, there is no pattern. You cannot make sense of this other than that to say that these are the utterances of a mad king and that people like Marco Rubio and Pete Hegseth and Pam Bondi have to listen to what he says and then backpedal furiously to backfill the rationale for what he did. And sometimes it's utterly ridiculous. Sometimes it's a complete non sequitur, you know, and sometimes they cobble together something that they contradict each other's excuses to explain what he said. Right. So there really is no logic behind this, but it's incredibly dangerous. You and I have talked for many years, decades now, about drug policy, particularly in Latin America. And today, I don't want to talk so much about drugs. I want to talk about oil. This is about oil, and it is probably the most dangerous situation we found ourselves in since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. It's that level of magnitude stupid, right? I think that we've always suspected that this has been about oil, not about drugs. And yesterday, Trump confirmed it on live television. And did the worst thing possible. And in fact, as outrageous as this snatch and grab operation is and all this, you know, boat strikes, he probably couldn't have gotten away with this kind of murderous behavior had he not also thrown in, yeah, we're going to take the oil as well, because that was the line he should not have crossed if for his own good, let alone the morality and ethics and the legality of all this. But it's stupid because Venezuela nationalized their oil in 1976, right? And they did it for very good reasons. That a century ago, in the early 1900s, they had a dictator who basically gave away all the oil so that three foreign corporations owned 90%+ of the oil in the country. And so it was stolen out from under them. And they nationalized it. They paid off the oil companies $1 billion, which is a lot of money, 1976 dollars. It is a sovereign right to nationalize key industries. The U.S. has done it. Our NATO allies have done it. Countries nationalize industries that are important to them. And there are few industries more important to Venezuela than oil. Now, how they've managed that and how they've distributed the wealth over the years and under different governments, we can talk about and debate. But it's their oil. And Trump is saying they've been stealing it from us for years, right? And so oil infrastructure is, we need to talk about that, because I spent a lot of time in neighboring Colombia, which has been at war all of my life since Lyndon Johnson sat in the White House, right? They've been having civil wars with various guerrilla groups. And one of the key targets has been oil infrastructure because it's so vulnerable and it's an easy way to hurt the government, which relies on these taxes to fund their military and do other things. And so the oil infrastructure is impossible to protect. You're talking about pipelines that stretch for hundreds of miles. You can't possibly position guards and have security cameras that could respond in time to any sudden attack. And so for years, this is 2 decades ago, when I would, wake up in the mornings in Putumayo, Colombia, I would look out at the horizon and you could see a different column of black smoke rising from the distance. And that's because the guerrillas had struck the pipeline at a different location the night before. And all they do is drive all around and they see a nice secluded spot. They shoot some holes into the pipeline. They throw a road flare onto it and poof, the thing goes up. So that's easy to do, right? And there were so many hundreds and hundreds of attacks on these pipelines that local Colombians called it the flute because it had so many holes in it, right? And now you combine that with modern technology, drone technology from the war in Ukraine, which has evolved at a lightning pace over the past 3 or 4 years now. And so at the beginning, they were using $500 hobbyist drones to drop a grenade onto a Russian tank or something, armor-piercing grenades. And it was very accurate, but slow and cumbersome, etc. And now they've switched to fiber optic guided drones that have these cables that can go for 10, 20, 30, even 50-kilometer spools of fiber optic cables. Right, so it's very difficult to jam these drones electronically, so they can strike from great distances and cause tremendous damage. And when you're talking about oil infrastructure, that's something that's very easy to do. They can blow up refineries, they can blow up storage tanks, not just pipelines. And so while Ukraine has been hammering the Russian oil industry so badly that Russia, which is famous for producing oil, it's their big thing, right? That's their gas station with nukes is how they've been described in the past. They are now forced to import gasoline from Asian countries. That's how bad these attacks have gotten. Now, Ukraine uses long-range drones because they have to hit hundreds of kilometers inside Russia or thousands of kilometers. In Venezuela, these insurgents, and you only need a few of them, and it costs very little money to do this, can blow up oil infrastructure from a very safe distance, 10, 20, 30 kilometers away, right? And you do that a couple of times, and you're not going to be able to attract the tens of billions of dollars of capital investments necessary by private oil corporations to revitalize and upgrade and modernize, basically rebuild the oil infrastructure of Venezuela. It's been underinvested for so long. It's not efficient. It's leaks like a sieve. It's not, they need a lot of capital investments. And in order to get that oil, it's going to take, capital investments into tens of billions of dollars. It'll take decades to pay off before these things become profitable. We don't know, they don't know what the demand of oil will be in 10 or 20 years from now, by the time they pay off these investments. And at the moment, they have plenty of renewable energy investments that are profitable right now. So getting them to plunk down serious money of their own into Venezuela when they don't know the security situation 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years from now, nobody knows. And so good luck trying to attract foreign investment to revitalize their oil that's somehow going to pay for the occupation and pay for everything else. That is a fantasy. And so basically what Trump did was he placed this into a vise and gave it to the Venezuelans. And he doesn't realize yet, but they have control of the vise. And they can tighten it when they want to, if they choose to do that. I'm not saying that there will definitely be an insurgency, but I think it's very likely there will be some level of insurgency. More than a year ago, Maduro distributed arms to his community groups. These community groups that go around doing his paramilitary violence and attacking opponents and that sort of thing. They're armed, well armed now. And Venezuela is twice the size of Iraq, full of dense Amazon jungles, high mountains, not open desert. This is a nightmare for counterinsurgency. And that's what we're looking at. And so it's important to learn from Colombians how they've had to deal with this for decades. And it's not easy to protect oil infrastructure. So that is number one. I think that's the big problem. It hinges on oil, and he's not going to be able to. It's not so easy just simply to take it. I think the other thing is that by announcing publicly that he's going after the patrimony of the nation, right? Venezuelans feel very proud of their nation, very proud of their oil. It is their number one export product. And now he says on live television, I'm going to take what belongs to all of you and decide how it's used. Now, there are a lot of people in Venezuela who hate Maduro, who probably would have acquiesced to a regime change by gringo imperialists. But when you go after their national patrimony, it takes a lot of those fence sitters and moves them into the side more sympathetic to rebelling against the occupiers, the invaders, right? So that was also very, very stupid. And there's also the question of Rubio, right? Marco Rubio. His objective is not only Venezuela, but ultimately it's Cuba. He has long wanted to have regime change in Cuba. And Cuba is in a very, very fragile state right now. It has always been in a very dire position because of the embargo, because of lack of investments, etc. And especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, they went through great hardships. And as a result, they have not been able to do capital investments in the power grid, their water system, the most basic elements you need to have a modern functioning economy. So last year, the island went completely dark several times. The entire power grid of the entire country collapsed because they haven't invested in it. It is so decrepit. It's held together by duct tape, basically, at this point. Last summer, there were extreme water shortages. People had to line up in Revolution Square to get a little bit of water to take back to their houses in Havana. That's just for drinking and cooking, carrying that amount of water. We can forget about toilet flushing and all the other things that make modern life possible. So what happens if you destabilize the Cuban government and cut off its oil, which it depends on from Venezuela? Well, you really put the regime in Havana on the brink. And if it collapses, if Marco Rubio gets his way, this is the ultimate pottery barn, right? You break it, you own it. And if we break the Cuban system, we're going to own a catastrophe. And you and I are old enough to remember the 1980 Mariel boat lift from Cuba, right? Where Fidel allowed anyone who wanted to leave, hey, go to Mariel. You know, the gringos will send a flotilla to pick you up. Get the hell out. Just go. And that was a disaster for the U.S. because not only did he allow all the political dissidents who wanted to leave, exit the country, but he also emptied a lot of his jails and mental institutions. So when Trump, he thinks this is crazy idea that people who apply for political asylum come from mental asylums, right? And no one dares correct him. But this is the only case that I know of where an actual mental asylum was emptied out to dump onto the U.S. And so the Carter administration, you know, pressured Cuba to release these people, let them go, let your people be free. And after Fidel said, okay, anyone can go, the State Department internally, they realized, oh, Fidel has just flushed his toilets on us. And so you have a mishmash of people, some of whom were you know, good, hardworking people who wanted to, you know, start a new life in Florida or whatever. And you also had a lot of these so-called delinquents and people with mental illnesses being released into Florida and the United States. And that was a big mistake. So we're looking at that kind of a collapse scenario, but much, much, much bigger. And Marco Rubio cannot stop hundreds of thousands of Cubans 90 miles from Florida from fleeing their country. And this would make it Stephen Miller's ultimate nightmare. Hordes of black and brown people flooding into Florida and the United States, right? And so I would give anything to see the fight they are having in between them about, you know, how this is going to play out. So not only has, you know, a huge amount of the Venezuelan population already fled the country, but now if they push Cuba over the brink, boy, they've just bought themselves the biggest headache you could possibly imagine. We can't even fix the power grid in Puerto Rico, which belongs to the United States. Somehow they're going to find money to rebuild the entire infrastructure of Cuba. That's not going to happen. And if you don't fix Cuba promptly, then people will leave and they will come here.
There's so much to talk about with this. One thing I will mention, it's not only oil, because you've also got what are called strategic minerals, these things in particular, something called coltan, columbide yep. tantalite, which is used in all kinds of stuff, electronics and smartphones, missile parts, night vision goggles, GPS systems. Yeah. I mean, it's a strategic mineral in the U.S., the EU, China, and Japan, according to this briefing by IPS Research. And it's not only those. They've also got the and there you've got armed groups, and it's right on the Colombian border. Who do you think's next?
Yeah. So last night, Trump on Air Force One gives us one of his gaggles and just shoots his mouth off. And he talks about, possibly, you know, attacking Greenland, Colombia, Mexico, and a whole list of countries. This is real madman stuff. He lost his mind. Attacking Greenland would probably trigger at some point Article 5 of the NATO, alliance. Attack on one is attack on all. There's some quibbling as to how it would be triggered, etc. But the United States attacking a NATO member is insane, number one. And he also talked about, Greenland has a lot of strategic minerals, these rare minerals, rare earths. So does Canada. So does Venezuela. All of these countries, he could have bought these. They're not embargoed. We could have purchased them on the market, paid a decent price. You could have, negotiated to have U.S. corporations enter there. But somehow Trump thinks he's got to own it. He's got to take it. All he had to do was ask nicely and pay, a decent market price for it. No problem. And you're still going to pay the market price because it's going to cost US corporations or Canadian corporations or European corporations the same amount of money to invest into the resource extraction and refining, right? So he has this obsession with taking stuff, whether it's taking oil, taking land, taking minerals, and it just causes so much problems. It makes no sense. And that's why I say there's no grand strategy, that Rubio and these people are just backfilling BS logic to try to make some sense into his insane ramblings. It's the exact opposite of every single presidential administration that came before him. There used to be a process. There used to be some degree of interagency coordination where the key stakeholders would come to the table and say, "Hey, have you thought about this problem? Have you think seen this, potential clash coming down the line? Or what if this impacts that or whatever?" They don't do that in this administration, as far as I can tell. Trump just says or tweets something stupid, and then they scramble to carry out his orders or try to make sense of them.
That was part one of my conversation with Sanho Tree, director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. I did this as a volunteer because I think that community radio is important. What do you think about community radio?
Oh, God, it's so important. Community media in general, local newspapers, community radio, local public television. This is time to support your locals, right? Especially when it comes to local corruption, covering these kinds of issues that, eventually get national attention. If you don't have local, then that stuff doesn't percolate up and it just allows for so much more corruption, and misconduct. Keep your local media alive and vibrant and donate to local radio and support public broadcasting in all its forms.
We'll bring you part two next week. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, I've mentioned that UN Security Council meeting on January 5th. We're going to hear some of the audio from that meeting. First, here's the intervention by the representative of Spain.
Mr. President, at the outset, allow me to congratulate you on assuming the monthly presidency of the United Nations Security Council and wish you every success in the discharge of your duties. I thank you for convening this important meeting, and I also extend my thanks to the Under Secretary General and Head of Political and Peacebuilding Affairs of the United Nations, Madame Rosemary DiCarlo. Thank her for the information provided today. Spain would like to express our profound concern about what's happened in Venezuela. And as the Secretary General of the United Nations has noted, it constitutes a very worrying precedent with implications for the region and for the world. Respect for the principles of the Charter of the United Nations, particularly the sovereignty and territorial integrity of states and the prohibition of the use or the threat of use of force, is indispensable to ensure international coexistence. Spain defends the validity of an international order that is rules-based, where it is imperative, as set out in Article 2.3 of the Charter, to pursue the peaceful settlement of disputes. We consider that these actions constitute a very troubling precedent for regional peace and security, and we recall that the natural resources of a country are part of its sovereignty. We share the view that the fight against organized crime in the region is a priority, but that fight can only be waged through international cooperation. We also share the view that it is a priority to defend human rights and fundamental freedoms in Venezuela. Spain seeks to work for peace, stability, democracy, progress, and social justice, and that cannot be imposed by force. It can only come through broad dialogue among Venezuelans, leading to a peaceful and democratic Venezuelan solution. It must be the voice of the Venezuelan people that determines the destiny of Venezuela. Spain did not recognize the results of the most recent elections held in Venezuela in July 2024 and has been unequivocal in condemning any violations and threats to human rights. We have provided protection to opposition leaders who have been persecuted and have expressed firm rejection of any undemocratic conduct and abuses against the citizenry. But such condemnation can only be exercised with full respect for international law. Spain will work to unite Venezuelans, men and women, and is committed to dialogue and peace because force never brings more democracy. Thank you, Mr. President.
That was the representative of Spain at that Security Council meeting January 5th. Now here's the representative of South Africa.
Thank you, Mr. President. We wish to congratulate the Federal Republic of Somalia for assuming the rotating presidency of the United Nations Security Council for the month of January and wish you and your delegation all the best in the execution of your responsibilities. We also wish to thank you for convening this debate and affording all UN member states to participate because the situation in Venezuela concerns all UN member states, given its implications for the credibility of the UN Charter and international law. Mr. President, integral to the maintenance of international peace and security since the establishment of the United Nations is the understanding that no nation can claim to be legally or morally superior to another. We are all nations born out of different histories and contexts, ascribing to the common values and principles enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. Chief amongst these principles is the sovereign equality of all its members. By signing the Charter, we have all committed to settle our international disputes by peaceful means in such a manner that international peace, security, and justice are not endangered. We have also committed to refrain in our foreign relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state, or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes and principles of the United Nations. The International Court of Justice has also previously affirmed that international law prohibits the use of force and intervention in another state's affairs. Due to the shortcomings of its predecessor, the League of Nations, the UN was created to prevent countries from resorting to conflict, to settle disputes and prohibit the use of force unless it is done in a legally prescribed manner. In doing so, the UN has played a pivotal role in ensuring peaceful existence amongst nations, including in ending the colonial subjugation by powerful countries over others, underpinned by respect for the equal rights of nations, large and small, and respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples. Joining the organization and committing to its principles afforded protection to many of us with the supposed assurance that no longer would one nation be seen as inferior to another. Unfortunately, when countries ignore the Charter and act contrary to its central premise, it undermines the credibility of the entire system in which we all undertake our international relations. The stability of the international system depends not only on the respect but on the consistent application of these established legal norms. We all benefit from a rules-based international order based on international law. When we break those norms, we invite anarchy and an environment where might makes right, ignoring the complexity of interrelations and interdependence in our modern world. Mr. President, the unilateral military strikes carried out by the United States of America against Venezuela and the abduction of President Nicolas Maduro and his spouse from Venezuelan territory for transfer to the United States wantonly violates the sovereignty and territorial integrity and independence of Venezuela. These actions are also in stark contrast to our established legal norms, reinforcing the belief that might is right and undermining diplomacy. History has repeatedly demonstrated that military invasions against sovereign states yield only instability and deepen crises. Unlawful unilateral force of this nature undermines the stability of the international order and the principle of equality among nations. Such use of force also undermines the institutional infrastructure established to regulate relations among nations. We have seen examples of these in Libya, Iraq, and countless cases in Africa where foreign interventions and interference create security crises, and undermine national governance institutions cultivated through nuanced and complex national contexts. South Africa stresses that allegations of internal governance challenges, human rights concerns, or acts of criminality by a head of state cannot justify a breach of the Charter's prohibition on the use of force, particularly Article 2.4 of the Charter. The peaceful resolution of disputes and internal matters must proceed in accordance with international law and through multilateral mechanisms. Additionally, under international law, a state has exclusive jurisdiction over persons and conduct within its own territory. Any enforcement of domestic law, including arrest by one state within the territory of another state without the state's consent, is an unlawful violation of sovereignty. There are recourse mechanisms at the disposal of states to implement international law. This includes taking action by bringing a case before the International Court of Justice or seeking action from the Security Council. We note the statement issued by a group of concerned countries, mainly those in the Latin American region, most affected by the developments in Venezuela, which reiterates that the situation in Venezuela must be resolved exclusively through peaceful means, through dialogue, negotiation, and respect for the will of the Venezuelan people in all its expressions, without external interference and in accordance with international law. Mr. President, each one of our countries, including our peoples, that are members of this organization and that are bound to its charters, have the right to determine our own democratic and political path. This inherent charter-given right to self-determination cannot and should not be abrogated. If we do not stand up for the sovereign rights of any nations or states when they are undermined and wantonly violated, then which one of us are safe or are guaranteed protection by the principles of the Charter and international law? Failure to act decisively against such violations is a tantamount to inviting anarchy and normalizing the use of force and military might as the main form of discourse in international politics. This would be a regression into a world preceding the United Nations, a world that gave us two brutal wars, world wars, and an international system prone to severe structural instability and lawlessness. We cannot afford to proceed into a complex future without the stability and protection afforded by international law. I thank you.
That was the representative of South Africa speaking at a Security Council meeting January 5th to discuss threats to international peace and security. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh.
And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support public media and local community radio. Become members. Become volunteers. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so
long.
For
the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.